Welcome to the Leadership 2.0 podcast. Current thinking in psychology is that there are five dimensions we can use to describe the most important personality dimensions. These dimensions are extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, neuroticism, and openness to experience. Dr. Ralph Pietmans discovered the sixth one, the numinous. Dr. Pietmans was a full professor in the Department of Pastoral Counseling at Loyola University, Maryland, and is now the managing director of the Center for Professional Studies. His current research interests focus on the measurement of spiritual transcendence, a construct that represents a broad, non-dominational, motivational measure of spirituality. During our conversation, we covered the following topics. The origins of the five-factor personality model. The five-factor personality model versus adopting a growth mindset. The dark triads. What the numinous is and the relevance of the numinous for agnostics and atheists. Practical implications of the numinous. Applications of the numinous in the world of business. Leadership development and the numinous. Dysfunctional leadership behavior and the numinous. And finally, will we ever move from the big five to the big six, the future of the numinous? Hey, Ralph, thank you so much to attending this podcast. I'm really looking forward to discuss with you the big five and the sixth dimension that you have, discovered in addition to the big five. But before we go into your work on the numinous, could you tell us a little bit what the big five are in psychology and why they are so important?
Okay, great. Very important question. This all began with the work of Gordon Allport. And he started off in 1938 with one of his doctoral students, Odbert. And what he was thinking, he came up with an idea called the lexical hypothesis. He said that language is a very important adaptive function for human beings, that it helps us to survive and to move along. And the reason is why. What does language do? Well, language gives us a way to concretize very important components of our adaptive landscape. You know, what food to eat, what food not to eat, who are friends, who are enemies, who can I trust, who can I not trust, you know, where to build a hut, or where to live or where not to live. And that we develop over time, our language becomes a repository of the adaptive struggles of our culture. And that we create words to reflect important aspects. For example, Eskimos have about 18 different words for snow.
Yeah.
How many words do you have for snow? Well, snow.
Now, I think one with two or three qualifiers in a sense of a soft, hard, white, brown. I think that's about the extent of
it. Yeah. But there's only one word you can put modifiers.
Absolutely. On. Yeah. I snow is snow. Yeah.
Snow is snow. But for Eskimos, not all snow is the same. There's snow that you use to build your igloos out of. There's snow that you got to watch out because you don't want to travel over it with your sled. So there's all different kinds of snow. So the lexical hypothesis basically says that over time, because human beings are social animals, and that our survival is very much tied up in our relationships with other people, that over time, it seems stands to reason that we would have encoded words that represent important aspects of people's personality as it relates to my survivability. That's the lexical hypothesis. So what he did is he went into the fourth unabridged Webster's Dictionary in 1935 and pulled out all the adjectives that seemed to be descriptive of human personality. And he wound up pulling out 17,956 adjectives is what popped out of all of this. Now, over the ensuing decades, researchers began to look at these items and included them in ratings, and they began to look at the intrinsic structure. And by 1964, people basically were saying that there's basically five broad dimensions that seem to characterize these adjectives. And those dimensions have become what's called the five-factor model of personality. Those dimensions are neuroticism, which looks at basically negative affect and our ability to cope and manage stress. There's extroversion, which has got two things. It's got our people-orientedness, do I like being with people and in social events? It also looks at our own personal energy and enthusiasm. People who are extroverting are very active, busy, engaged people. Our third dimension is openness to experience, which is basically examining the psychological permeability between my environment and myself. People high on openness are creative, flexible, curious, they're seekers. People low on openness are very rigid and dogmatic and like structure and following routines. The fourth dimension is agreeableness, which is our orientation from people, from very compassionate, caring, Mother Teresa-ish, to very manipulative, cynical, revengeful, very Machiavellian on the other dimension. And finally, there's conscientiousness, which is basically our goal-directedness, our personal organization and reliability. So those five dimensions have been found to be very, very important. Even though they emerge from the English lexicon, they've been found to exist in languages all across the planet, and most importantly, in languages that don't share an etymological root with English, like Russian or Chinese or Japanese. We find these same factors there. So it seems that these dimensions are universal qualities that all cultures found important to their survival, so much so that they now created a word to represent these ideas. We've also found that about 50% of the variants in these dimensions are genetically heritable. So they're built into who we are as people. And these five factors are all independent of one another. So it's a multidimensional model. And we find that this model has great interpretive value, but it also has wonderful predictive value as well. So it's a very important model for understanding personality. And it's also a taxonomy of personality dimensions, okay, that people, it is a taxonomy of those personality dimensions traditionally assumed or dealt with or believed to be personality dimensions in the field of psychology, okay? So neuroticism is always, neuroticism and extroversion are the big two because they're everywhere.
It's in the work of Jung, for instance,
Absolutely. And Ising is another one. And then Ising brought in psychoticism, which was A and C, basically. And openness is the newest dimension to be added to all of this. And in fact, openness is the newest personality dimension. Okay, because these five factors didn't all appear at once. And I did some research to show that there's a really a time effect for their emergence, and that extroversion and agreeableness are the oldest, have the oldest adjectives. And then it's neuroticism and conscientiousness, and then openness, the in a sample of adjectives that I used, they peaked at 1750 and 1850 were the two peaks for a lot of these adjectives entering the English lexicon. And that corresponds with the introduction of the scientific method and the Industrial Revolution, places where openness and creativity became very important for our survival. So it's a very powerful model.
The question I have around the Big Five, and I asked it, let's say, to a number of psychologists in the past, and I must honestly say that a number of them struggle to come up with an answer. Right now, let's say, you already said about, you know, the predictive value that the Big Five have. You also written an article, let's say, in terms of how it can predict you know, potential ratings by supervisors in business. Right now, let's say in the business world, one of the buzzwords or the dogmas is, you know, adopting a growth mindset. So whatever your limitation is, adopt a growth mindset and, so work on your limitations. So if you look at, let's say, the Big Five in terms of openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism, how stable are they? And to which degree can people develop them?
Okay. Well, that's a very good question. You know, we all know that over time, we're different, right? Are you the same man you were 25 years ago?
It's a good question. I think I definitely changed in some aspects, both in terms of behavior as well as in outlook mentally. Yeah.
Okay. But you're still the same guy, right?
I still have the same passport and the same name in the passport. And
No. Let's get a little more intimate. When you reflect back on that man from 25 years ago, you recognize that it's you, right?
Yeah, definitely.
It's not a stranger. It's not some alien. It's you. It's part of who you are. Okay, so you're still the same guy there. So when we talk about change over time, there's change and then there's change. There's what we call phenotypic change And then there's genotypic change, okay? What we've got to realize is that human growth over time is not a linear process. I like to call it like a trajectory through time. It's like an arc. We're always changing, but that change is lawful in what we're doing, okay? In that, for example, think of the extroverted undergraduate student. Think about a 19-year-old or 20-year-old boy who's very extroverted. What do? Well, they go out a lot. They party a lot. They have a lot of unprotected sex. They sleep late because they're out late in the morning, et cetera. They're party animals. That's who they may use drugs. Okay, they engage in risky behaviors. That's who they are. But you fast forward 25 years and you talk about the same extroverted student who's now a middle-aged man. He's still extroverted, but is he doing the same thing? Is he still going out late at night, still using drugs? Is he still having unprotected sex with many sexual partners? Well, I hope for his wife's sake, I hope not. He's very different, but he's still an extrovert. Now, as an adult, he may have involvement in a lot of social organizations. He may like having a lot of dinner parties and hosting people over at his house. He may enjoy just spending doing the things that extroverts like to do in middle age. Clearly, his behaviors have changed, but he's still high on extroversion because what extroversion is means different things at different points of our lifespan. Okay, Arnold Schwarzenegger is another one of my famous examples. He was Mr. Universe. You look at him at 25 years old, he has got the perfect male body. You look at him today as a 70-plus-year-old man, he certainly doesn't have the pecs. His butt's a little saggier, you know, he's a little fleshier, but he's still a muscular guy because what muscularity means is different at different parts of the lifespan. So again, for yourself, your attitudes are different, some of your behaviors are different, but it doesn't mean that you fundamentally or genotypically have changed. It's just the style has changed. So our style is always amenable. That's phenotypic change. There's always plasticity in there. Casa McCrae did a very interesting study that addresses this question head on. They were part of, they have a longitudinal research study on aging that started in 1958, still going on. They have people come back every 5-10 years to get reassessed. It's a whole long thing. And what they did when one of the waves came in one year, they give them the NEO as part of what they do. And they asked them a question. They said, in the last 10 years, how much do you think you've changed as a person on a 1 to 7 scale? 1 being I'm still the same person. 7 means I'm a new creature of God. And so they gave them, they got a wide range of ratings. Most of the ratings were 1, 2, or 3. So most of the people saw themselves as pretty much the same person as the last 10 years. But there was groups that had moderate change and big change. And then what they did is they went back and got their NEOs from 10 years ago. And they looked at the retest reliability of these three different groups. Those that didn't change, those that stayed the same, and those that are radically different. The group that didn't change, their test retest reliability, 0.80. Test retest reliability for the moderate change, 0.78.
And that's still very, very considerable.
Now we're coming to the denouement. For the group that changed the most, their test retest reliability, 0.81. So there's a tremendous amount. About 80% of the variance in personality remains stable in adulthood, even in a group that thought they changed immensely in the past 10 years. So again, when we look at change, we have to think of genotypic versus phenotypic change. Genotype doesn't change, and that's the big five. Phenotype, it's an open book. It depends on your adaptation, your environment, you know, what's going on in your life. But the changes that happen are always lawful changes. An extrovert will never become an introvert. And again, that proves Jung's theory incorrect. He talks about the increasing differentiation that people move to the dark side as they get older. So their personality goes to the other direction. There's no evidence for that whatsoever empirically. No. So it is who you are. William James said that in adulthood, personality is set like plaster. And that after age 30, you're pretty much, this is pretty much who you're going to be. Now, some people find that a very frightening and it's like, oh, that's terrible kind of reality. But it's not a terrible reality. It's a very important adaptive function of our species. Having stability and personality allows us to make long-term commitments. We can do things like get married, okay? Because when you marry somebody, you're hoping yeah, I love this person. I don't want them to change. And if they do, that's why we have divorces. It's like, that's not the same person I married before. So we can make commitments to work. We can make commitments in relationships. Having this kind of stability provides us with a lot of adaptive efficiency in our lives. So it's a good thing.
Yeah. Another topic connected to the Big Five, and I don't know if you have any specific opinions about it, is what they call the dark triads. Well, what is your perception on that phenomenon? Is it something that you recognize, that you can connect to the Big Five?
Oh, absolutely. It's very much connected to the Big Five, but low A, high N. The dark triad is really emerging out of the clinical psychology literature. Again, trying to look at the things that underpin psychopathology in people, especially when you talk about sociopaths and psychopaths, you know, some of the more extreme types of personality, the dark triad seems to get in there. And again, it reflects this manipulative, selfish, narcissistic orientation to the world where people may not be very empathic of others. There's a lot of distress that may be driving some of this behavior. People are looking to find some type of emotional succorance and security in the environment that they're in, and they're willing to do whatever it takes to get what they need to have. And in fact, it's interesting, you know, when you look at psychopathology, the big predictor of that is neuroticism. In fact, I see the DSM-5 as basically a pay-on to the dimension of neuroticism, and that over 98% of all the disorders have N as its foundation. And that's great, but, you know, it doesn't explain everything. And when we get into the numinous, we'll find out that there's aspects of the numinous that provide an independent pathway to pathology that's separate from neuroticism, and that provides its own sense of maladaptiveness that can have a crushing impact on the psychology of an individual. And I'll just put that out there as a little flirtation for a little later on in our
talk. That is super, because that was where I wanted to take the conversation next. In the last couple of years, you published a number of articles advocating that there should be a sixth dimension in addition to the five we already discussed. And the sixth one would be called the numinous. Could you perhaps explain what you mean with the term numinous?
The numinous, yes. Well, again, as I said earlier, I started in this line of research in the psychology of religion and spirituality, looking at these kinds of dynamics, trying to understand what they are, trying to come up with an empirically sustainable definition for spirituality and religiousness that finds its roots in the Big Five. I think I was been very successful in doing that. The numinous is a very interesting characteristic. Let me tell you my most exciting aspect of the numinous. The Big Five is a very important adaptive quality, not only for human beings, but also for animals too. You can measure the Big Five in your pet cat and your pet dog. You can do that reliably and validly. But, you know, there's a big question. When I was an undergraduate, I was taking a course in abnormal psychology. And my professor at the time said something that just blew me away in my seat. I mean, it was like, really? He was talking about a particular psychological disorder. And what he said was this. He said, this disorder is a uniquely human disorder. There are no animal models for this. We cannot create this any other place. It only seems that human beings have this problem. Any guess on what that disorder is?
I'm not sure. I couldn't answer that. No, is it a question about, let's say, our own mortality or reflection on mortality?
You get a little ahead. No, the disorder was schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is a uniquely human disorder. This blew me away, because in psychology, you read Freud, and Freud is, you know, talking about all these animal models. We have instincts and herd mentality and this, the whole thing with Freud is that he dethroned human beings. And he said, there's nothing special about us. We're an organism like other organisms. And that didn't always go down well for a lot of people. So seeing something, and in psychology, everything we study is all about things that are found in other species, except schizophrenia. And what is schizophrenia? Schizophrenia is a cognitive disorder that represents a breakdown in personal meaning making. People have a fragmented sense of self. They have a fragmented sense of ideas and connections. There's a disconnect between their thoughts and their affect. And when you talk to schizophrenics, you really see the fragility of their sense of, of self. You really see a lack of connection in making meaning in their lives that creates anxiety and distress and leads to a lot of very negative outcomes. I thought this was phenomenal until I got along to the numinous. And one of the things about the numinous is that when it comes to personality, the numinous is another uniquely human quality. There are no animal models for the numinous. No other species has the numinous other than us. And ontologically, where does this come from? It comes from our tremendous cognitive capacities as an organism. The one thing that makes human beings so special is our brain power, our ability to think, to reflect, to plan, to understand, to manipulate, to conceptualize things in unique and different ways, creativity. All of this is unique to who we are. And as we apply these cognitive powers to ask questions, why does it rain? Why doesn't it rain? What's going to happen tomorrow? We begin to realize when we apply this to ourselves that we are a sentient being. We know that we're alive, and we know that other things aren't alive.
The self-consciousness part, yeah.
Absolutely. That's an awareness that no other animal has. And what comes along, so we have this whole cognitive space, affective cognitive space that's unique to who we are, that enables us to do incredible things. You know, I mean, when God says he created us in his image, you know, one answer to what does that mean? It means that human beings are like God in that, one, we know the difference between right and wrong. And number two, we can create and we can destroy just like God can. That's a tremendous power and capacity that we have. And when that power and capacity is focused on ourselves, that's when we get into the world of existentiality. Okay. And when we look at who are we? What are we doing here? What is life all about? We stumble across three key questions or three key fears that underlie the numinous. And those questions are, is death the end? Two, is there meaning in life? And three, am I good enough as a person? Now, this is not self-esteem, but it's a larger thing. Paul Tillich talks about this very eloquently in The Courage to Be. But it's the idea that life itself will question us at different parts in our lives and ask us, so what are you doing, Dirk? Are the things that you're doing good enough? Are they helpful enough? Are you making a positive contribution, or are you not doing that? You know, it's this sense of that, yes, I may have flaws, I may be imperfect, but I'm good enough versus I'm not good enough. I'm a tragedy. I should never have been born.
Because one of the things that we discussed that interests me really about the numinous, and I also read it in some of your publications, I can really, basically coming from a Christian background and being Christian myself, I could basically see this basically, you know, in every major religion playing a role, right? The question of, you know, is death the end? What is the meaning of life? Am I good enough? I mean, you know, whether you're Hindu, Islam, Christian, I see it coming back in all religions. But absolutely. The interesting thing is that when I read your article, you said you also recognize it with atheists or with agnostic people. So can you explain why it basically is in that sense universal and not constrained to people who have a religious conviction?
Absolutely, because it's a universal quality of our humanity. We all have these cognitive abilities. We all ask these existential questions. The value of religion, as you rightly pointed out, every religion answers those three key questions. Is death the end? No, you have an immortal soul. Is there meaning in life? Absolutely, God has a plan for you. And am I a good enough person? Well, yes, God made you and said you're good, but if you feel you screw up, there's always divine forgiveness. The value of religion is that it provides easily accessible answers to complex existential questions. Okay, and that's its real big value. But atheists and agnostics, they don't like those answers. They don't accept those answers that religion gives. And because they don't accept those answers, doesn't mean that they don't ask those questions. They do ask those questions. They do concern themselves with those questions, but they find a different set of principles to use to find an answer to help them move on. We all ask this question, okay? We all do. Some choose religion as a way of gratifying it, some don't, but we all ask this question. And we all come up with different ways of orienting ourselves to the universe as we understand it. And, you know, I think in our own minds, we all create a psychological diorama of ourselves. You know, this is the world as I understand it. Here's me, you know, going through this world. We all have to do that. We all need to create this understanding of the world and how we engage it and where we want to go with it. And we all find answers for it. For religious people, I want to go to heaven. For non-atheists, it's one, I want to live a good, righteous life that provides value to the world that I'm in.
Yeah, I think you could, perhaps you could explain it almost that, let's say, it's the fact that you're dealing with those questions almost independent of the answers. So the degree to which you deal with those questions and those questions play a role in your life would influence, let's say, the numinous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the drive. The drive that propels us to ask those questions.
I see that. And then I also see now why that basically is as valid for people who have a religious background or have a belief system or people who don't, because those mm-hmm. questions will definitely play a role.
Absolutely.
What I wonder about the numinous as a kind of sixth dimension, what is, let's say, what would be practical applications of that Ralph? For instance, if you think about you know, psychotherapists or coaches, or what do you see as the practical application if you work with someone or who basically is either scoring high or low on numinous?
Well, the numinous has a lot of implications, especially for in the clinical area. I think there's disorders out there like moral injury. I don't know if you're familiar with the term. This has come up recently as our troops came back from Iran and Afghanistan. A lot of people seem to be exhibiting these PTSD symptoms.
Yeah.
You know, they get PTSD treatment, but it doesn't seem to work. If they seem refractive to it because there's something else going on with them that they're not understanding what's happening. To me, that's the numinous. It's worthiness. That things like suicide, substance abuse, body image dysphoria, moral injury. These are the kinds of disorders that are existentially linked, and that in any effort to make progress with people, you need to address these numinous issues. You need to look at things like worthiness, particularly worthiness, and meaning become very important. And to be able to deal with them at this higher level, you know, it's more than just the pain that people are feeling. Worthiness has a lot of emotional distress. In some of my research, I've shown that people who score very low on worthiness have indicate more suicide attempts. I think more about killing themselves than those that are lower on it. They tend to have many more struggles and tend to be seen by psychiatrists or go to emergency rooms for psychiatric care much more frequently than those that are lower on it. So there's a lot of emotional angst and pain. But it's not an angst and pain that comes from our neuroticism. It comes from this feeling that my personhood is flawed in a critically bad way. And to address that, it's going to take more than just assuaging anxiety or depression. It's more than an antidepressant. There's something much more deeper here that needs to be taken out and evaluated with a client. So in those kinds of disorders, the numinous is absolutely critical. But in any disorder that people have, addressing these concerns are always there. People in therapy always have worthiness issues. Now, maybe it could be a self-esteem issue more than a worthiness, but looking at worthiness augments that kind of engagement with somebody. Finding purposeful meaning in life is good. And in fact, well, I'll get this, I'll save that for a little later, but meaning is something that I've well developed in the model of the numinous. Working off of Viktor Frankl, you know, Viktor Frankl thought that having meaning is better than not having meaning. And he's
men in search of meaning. Yeah,
absolutely. But one of the things that some of my work has shown is that not all meaning making is the same. Some ways of making meaning provide more resilience, more adjustment than other ways of making meaning. Okay, so again, we need to understand how clients are making meaning. The psychotherapy or traditional psychology, you know, talks about minimum levels of well-being, you know, that mental health is not just the absence of symptoms, but the ability, as Freud say, to love, work, and play, okay, which is, okay, that's okay. But there's something, there's higher levels of well-being. Eudaimonia is a nice term that's come out recently to capture this, whatever this very high level of a lifestyle of well-being and resilience. And that's a whole different meaning-making approach than those that on the lower levels of all of this. So looking at how clients make meaning, moving away from a solipsistic self-involved approach, or what David Bentley Hart calls, I love this word, hyparxiolatry. That's a mouthful. It took me a day to learn how to say that, hyparxiolatry. But what hyparxiolatry is, and these are people who are low on the numinous, it's a selfishness. It's a type of idolatry where my self-survival is the idol, that I need to do everything for me and myself. So I become very miserly in giving resources to others because it comes out of my resources. So, you know, it's the same kind of orientation as thieves and murderers, as Henry Hart says that they have. It's all about them. So a lot of psychiatric clients have this very, because of the ongoing crises in their lives, has this very self-focus that, while they can make meaning that way, it's a very limited and fragile kind of meaning that can crack very easily. So we want to take clients to a more durable sense of meaning, at least bringing in social relationships as being an important thing, developing social support. But more importantly, it's moving to a more transpersonal perspective, where we start understanding our lives in a much broader sense of ourselves, where transcendence, which is part of the numinous, is our capacity to step outside of the immediacy of our time, place, and space, and understand our lives from a broader, ultimately eternal time perspective. You know, and that when you start understanding your life, psychological time is a very important quality for who we are and how we orientate ourselves to life. But when you start thinking that your life now is but one step in a larger ontological process, that's a very freeing thing. You know, if you think that, you know, I may die, but I move on to the next life, well, that opens the door to lots of activities, to a what I call for going all in attitude. Think of someone like Mother Teresa. Okay, this young woman grows up. She says, I want to take care of these dying people in India, and I want to do this with everything I have, and I give my life to it. Yeah. Why does she do that? Because this is only one stage in something bigger and more wonderful for me.
Yeah.
You know, so life will continue eternally. So I am free to invest myself passionately, fully, and unequivocally in things that have a positive transformative sense to themselves.
Right? Now, I definitely see that. If you think about, let's say, numinous, we basically talked quite about it, let's say, what it means in psychotherapy, what it means in therapeutic sessions. Do you see applications in business life?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Can you tell me a little bit, let's say, what the relevance would be, let's say, for business leaders to understand this concept, or organizations to understand it, HR people? Why would this be relevant for them to know, and what could they do with it?
Absolutely. Again, that dovetails with the work that I've been doing with the folks at the Gabelli School of Business at Fordham University. In that, you know, the traditional model of business is, you know, I'm the boss, you're the worker, you come, you give me your 8 to 10 hours a day of work, and I give you a pay.
Yeah, the purely transactional relationship. Yeah.
Right. Or what is the Asian model? It's the 996 model, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. You know, you come, you toil, you get paid, you go home, kind of thing. Well, that takes a big toll on workers. People get burned out. People lose purpose. They lose meaning. It's a large part of their life that they're investing in this endeavor. And what are they really getting out of it? They're just a cog in a wheel. They're just, you know, they could be replaced at any moment by anybody else. Maybe even a machine can do it. So what happens is business becomes inefficient. It becomes sloppy. People aren't happy. They're not passionate. And that everything about the business will begin to suffer. You know, the products you build will be less than ideal. The services that you provide, again, less than ideal. The satisfaction that people are deriving from their work, less than ideal. That's why a lot of companies have high turnover. And again, turnover costs money.
Yep, you know, to train somebody,
you know, especially in higher order jobs, like an insurance salesman, for example. in a lot of insurance companies, it takes at least 6 months to train somebody to sell your insurance, to go through the policies, the procedures, and what it means, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And during that time, you're just paying this person. They're not generating any income.
Yeah, you also have to hope that there's a kind of cultural fit, there's a kind of long-term interest. Yeah.
Absolutely. And what happens after 6 months? You train this person and they say, nope, this is not for me. And they leave. Well, you just wasted hundreds of thousands of dollars on paying their salary and training them and doing all this stuff. So there's a real cost to this kind of deprived kind of work lifestyle. And there's an increasing recognition that, you know, if we can do more for our employees to recognize who they are as people, to help them, to empower them to be more creative, more involved, to instruct them on how to establish more productive relationships with their colleagues, with their superiors, with their subordinates, to learn how to handle conflict in productive ways, to see the bigger picture for a company, that we realize that a company can both do good for its employees and do well from the bottom dollar net income kind of perspective. In that if you get a highly grouped of employees that are well-motivated or passionate about the work that you're doing, you're going to get a lot more productivity out of them and be a lot more successful as a company. So the question is, how do we make that happen? How do we impact managers to think this way? It's called the humanistic paradigm to doing all of this. Yeah. And at Fordham, they've come up with principles of management course, they've infused it with this whole humanistic thinking, where an altruistic paradigm is brought in there, where we try to train these students in cognitive flexibility, conflict management, how to work with groups, how to engage people productively, transparently, not to be defensive, in an effort to hopefully create future managers who will take this learning and take these skills to real business environments and help transform the business world. Now, part of all of this is the numinous. All of this is, how do people create meaning? Again, my job, I spent a lot of time on my job. I've spent way too many years in the field of psychology. You know, over 40 years I've been in psychology. I love psychology. You know, it's got a high amount of meaning for me. So I just keep working and working and doing this. It's exciting. And I try to be as productive as possible because it's just so meaningful. But if I was in an environment that wouldn't allow me to do that, then I dry up, burn out, and just, you know, lose interest in life very quickly. And that's not where I want to be. And that's not where you want to have your business people, employees to be. So to get people to create a meaning where their job and their personal meaning have a good fit, where people see the value of the services they're providing, they see their worth and value as an agent providing these services to others that makes them feel worthwhile, and to give a sense that, you know, it's very important to us as we live our finite mortal lives to feel that there's some durability to what we're doing. You know, you're doing these podcasts. Why do you do these things, Dirk? Why are you here? Because you have this. Let me put the answer in for you.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. I'll test it. Yeah.
Makes my argument go a lot easier. But you're doing it because you want to give something to life. This works out of your need for worthiness, your sense of meaning, but also your sense of infinitude. That I use the metaphor that we're like a stone that's dropped into a pond. You know, the stone hits the water and goes quickly to the bottom of the pond. That's like our lives. We're here for a brief moment and then we're gone. But the ripples that stone made on the surface of the pond continue to resonate out from that point of view.
Yeah, it's your legacy.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. My works, my articles, hopefully someday somebody will read them. You know?
Yeah. at least I already did. So that's basically something you already got back in this life. Yeah,
exactly. But hopefully after this life, people will continue to read, you know, my work, find value to it. I have children. They will go on. My teaching, my students, I trained all of these dozens and dozens of doctoral students. I have my way of thinking to some degree. Gave them skills and competencies, and they're off carrying out the message themselves in other places. All of that speaks to our sense of infinitude. So all of this gets wrapped up into our work environment, that we make a difference in our business. We make a contribution that will help my identity live on in some way, shape, or form, that my ingrainedness in humanity is not limited to my mortal existence. The self goes on, either in another life, or it continues through the actions, the repercussions of my actions in this life.
Yeah, and that's the ripples.
That's how atheists too, that my life goes on. So all of this becomes important, and that's all reflected in the new curriculum they came up with. And we've been doing a series of studies there, measuring these students at the beginning of the semester, the end of the semester, to see how this course is impacting the students.
Yeah.
And we find that, of course, has a major impact on the students. It impacts their cognitive flexibility. It impacts their conflict management style. It impacts their empathic listening. It also impacts, and this is a twofold result here, it also impacts their sense of the numinous, that we find that over the course of the semester, scores significantly change for the better. Okay.
Yeah.
But even more importantly, okay, that those changes causally impact changes on other variables, in that the reason why empathic listening goes up is because their numinous orientation increases. As their sense of meaning and worthiness goes up, they're able to listen more intently to what other people have to say. They're more resilient in coping with stress. They're more able to manage conflict in a healthy, productive way rather than in a defensive, intimidated way. And it's the numinous that drives those changes. So the numinous is a very powerful motivational variable.
Do you think the concept of luminous could also be applied to leadership development programs in organizations?
That's a very big question. I don't know if we have enough time to give a thorough answer to all of that.
Now, but perhaps you can give some indications.
I'm going to give it my best shot. First of all, the concept of leadership is a very complex thing. Leadership, especially successful leadership, is really a combination of the right person at the right time for an organization at the right level of development. You know, a lot of new companies, one of the problems that companies have is as the company develops, it needs different kinds of leaders. You know, like think about Apple Corporation, for example. You know, it is a small little group, and Steve Jobs was the inspirational leader. He was the guru, and he inspired people. And again, small companies need that. They need the passion. They need the motivation. And again, some of this is numinously based. You know, it touches onto people's sense of meaning, their worthiness, and their sense of infinitude. I'm doing something great. I'm revolutionizing the world. And people really resonate that.
Yeah.
And his company grew tremendously. But there got to a point where Steve Jobs wasn't, his inspirational, you know, laid back style wasn't able to run a multi-billion dollar corporation. So what did they have to do? As they use in their own terms, they had to get an adult in the room, and they got
Scully. In the form of John Scully.
Because they needed a real technocrat now to manage the nuts and bolts of. So again, we need a different kind of leader. And a lot of companies, you know, these transition points can be very challenging for a company if they can successfully negotiate the jump from one type of quality to another, then the company can move on, like in the case of Apple. But in other companies where they can't make that transition, they keep the same inspirational guy, you know, who's becoming less and less effective, and the company will peak and then decline, and we're off the charts again. So, you know, we've got to keep in mind that companies have their own ontological cycle of maturation and development requiring different things at different points. And there's all different kinds of leaders, you know, as you were talking about, the narcissistic leader, the bipolar leader, the psychopathic leader. I mean, yeah, these guys and gals are out there, no doubt. But then again, there's also the positive, the inspirational leader, the collaborative leader, you know, there's more positive styles as well. All of these kinds of qualities have some implication on the numinous. Again, looking and seeing and contextualizing your life in a broader time dimension gives you a whole different attitude and understanding of the meaning, purpose, and direction of the things that you're doing now. You know, one dimension that, you know, when we talk about meaning making, we have two dimensions. I have a model of meaning making that I call the Logoplex, in honor of Viktor Frankl. It works off of some of his things. And there's three dimensions there. One dimension is this transpersonal versus material dimension. And the other one is a self focus versus an other focus, okay? And that creates a circular ordering. But the third dimension that's in there is the time frame that we use from doing all of these things. Our time perspective, which can be very small. I need to pay my rent this week. So everything I do is to get the money so I don't get kicked out of my apartment at the end of the week. It can be a little bit longer. I'm going to get my PhD in psychology. So hopefully that's just a 5 to 7 year project. Could be longer, but again, it's a little bit longer of a window. Yeah. And again, the longer, or I'm getting married, and this is going to be a lifetime commitment. Each of these time frames are getting bigger and bigger. And the longer the time frame, or what I refer to as the event horizon, the more stability.
that reminds me a little bit of an article I read about black holes. So
absolutely, yeah. you're yeah. going in, yeah. you're going yeah. into something. But yes, the event, the longer that event horizon, the more stability and resilience that you have in life, because yeah. you have the bigger picture going on, and these little blips, these little daily hassles and stuff, have less of a disorienting impact on you than if you had a very short time frame. And if you just continue this logic out and say, what if I have an eternal time frame? Well, that provides, in our model, the most resilience for people and the most psychological freedom to invest themselves. Zimbardo did some very good studies on time perspective. You know, he did a scale on time perspective with his student Boyd, and they looked at time from past orientation, present orientation, yeah. and future orientation. They found very much similar findings that I just told you. The longer, the more future oriented you are, the more resilience and stability you have. But they also realized that, why do I have to stop it with the end of my life? So they came back and created a transcendent time perspective, where it brings in this immortal or eternal yeah. time. And they find that the resilience gets better, people's stability are better, the outcomes psychologically are better.
Yeah.
And his scale on time perspective correlates over 0.75 with scores on my numinous motivation inventory. So again, yeah. they're very much locked together. So having that time perspective, when you have the long range time perspective, you know, it's not about meeting quarterly profit returns. It's not about getting the best stock quote at the end of this quarter. Yeah. And you start seeing what you're doing in the long term. You know, you're taking the long term
yeah.
view, like Tesla.
No, but I also think that's incredibly important. I mean, also if I look at let's say the development of leaders, mm-hmm. yeah, it's a matter of, you know, giving people space and time.
And
the less space and time you give them for development, the more directive you need to be, the less they learn. The less, you know, your organization as a whole become adaptive.
Absolutely.
Motivation level, engagement plummets. So taking, let's say, a longer perspective in terms of, you know, development of individuals, results, taking time to create, let's say, buy-in in projects, commitment, etc., is incredibly essential. I mean, it reminds me of an African saying that someone once said to me. He basically said, look, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that also means investing time, investing the space in them to, do things in their own, pace, in their own time, as long as there's clarity in terms of, you know, the goal, the objectives, and the purpose. And you know, sometimes in business, you simply don't have that luxury because, you know, there is, let's say, a financial objective or a business objective. There's a hard deadline needs to be realized, especially if you talk about, you know, external clients or financial commitments. But in situations where you do have that luxury to have a more inclusive and also a more development perspective, the more effective that is for your organization in the longer run.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well put. Yeah. The only thing I would add is that, you know, in any company, you have both tactical and strategic goals.
Yeah.
Tactically, we have to make a profit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And we have to make the profit now, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But and so everybody realizes.
Yeah, but strategically, we have a North Star. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's the big thing that everyone's going for is we're following this star. We're going in that direction. Yeah. So they both go along simultaneously. When they're in balance is a good thing. when they get out of balance, so that companies just pay lip service to the strategic view and put all of their real focus and time into the tactical outcomes, that's when we get this dystopic kind of corporate environment where people get used up and spit out. You see it a lot in the big three accounting firms. You know, where I know my wife is an accountant, and I said, "What?"
Yeah, or in, let's say, a number of consulting organizations, or big lawyer, big legal firms, where people are expendable, and people are in the truest sense of the word human resources, with, let's say, the accent on the word resources. Yeah,
absolutely, they grind up, spit them out. So, you know, that's where their real focus is, on that tactical thing, and they only pay lip service to the big strategy thing. So again, when you bring things into balance, I think you have a more harmonious and resilient corporation that's going to weather whatever little crises come up in time. But the big picture, you've got all these mobilized people who are really committed to what it is that they're doing and take great pride in what they're doing. Yeah. And that will always make your company successful.
If I go back to the numinous, because one of the things that I found fascinating is also what you see a lot of business is dysfunctional leadership behavior, and one of, let's say, the gurus in that field is Manfred Katz de Vries, of professor of leadership development emeritus at INSEAD. And Manfred Katz de Vries has done a lot of research about dysfunctional behaviors of top leaders. And he distinguishes four types of dysfunctional leaders. So the narcissistic leader suffers from delusion of grandeur, displays selfish and entitled behaviors. Bipolar leader lives of fear of impending disaster. And, basically to prevent that imagined circumstance, cling on an illusion of control, which basically, winds up in manifests itself as micromanagement in the office. You have the psychopathic leader, unable to empathize with others. And then finally, you have the obsessive compulsive leader, which disguises the disorder as perfectionism, and their attention to detail and insistence on high quality, can be organizational assets. However, when nothing less than perfection is accepted, innovation grinds to a halt. Which of those four types of dysfunctional behaviors could you potentially identify with STS? Or is there, let's say, a meaningful relationship between those four types of dysfunctional leaders and the numinous?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very good question. Those four types really share a lot in common with each other. From the big five perspective, high neuroticism would characterize just about all of these people. Mm-hmm. And then you'd bring in things like the low A is more of your narcissist and maybe your psychopathic leader. You have low C, which is your obsessive compulsive guy. You have low O, which is your rigid person, et cetera. The psychopathic has no empathy, et cetera. So, I mean, the big five could be very good at capturing a lot of these broad dimensions here.
Yeah.
Again, this would be a very interesting place. It would be a growing edge for research in with the numinous into this area here. But I would say, yeah, the numinous is going to pick this up. One of the things that you're going to find is low worthiness in all these people. Mm-hmm. Right? That's something that's the weakness that's going to be driving
that, that
a lot.
Yeah, that could drive a lot of, let's say, that fanatism, lack of, that wanting to keep control in all possible circumstances. Yeah.
Absolutely, because I'm not as bad as I think I am. Or I'm not as bad as others may think I am. That I need to get, people are trying to find their own sense of reconciliation, their own sense of forgiveness, their own sense of empowerness, of moving away from their weaknesses. And of course, because there's some major emotional dysphoria here, the things that they do are not going to be very productive. Neuroticism is this force. It gives us a lot of energy and passion to do things, but a lot of times, plus it's negative energy, it gets in the way of successful efforts. And that's what we see here. And I think we see a lot of low worthiness on the aspires. Connectedness is very much related to narcissism. So people low on connectedness are very high on narcissism. So connectedness would have something to do with the narcissistic leader. Worthiness, I think, would be pervasive through all of these. Yeah. Now, whether there's an individual profile associated with each of the four, that I don't know. We'd have to collect some data and see.
Yeah, but that might be a very interesting potential area of research, as you said.
Sure.
It would be really interesting to connect those four types of, you know, dysfunctional leadership with the big five and the numinous scale. I think that would be really interesting. Yeah,
absolutely. If we take the whole big six model,
yeah,
I would be very confident that we could find very specific profiles for each of those four types across the big six. You know, any one dimension, maybe less so, but it's going to be a profile. And with those six dimensions, I think we can nail each one of those four groups.
I think given the importance, let's say, of leadership, whether it's, let's say, in business, politics, or anywhere in society, I think that could be also great to basically, you know, have the right diagnostic tools at a certain moment to have conversations with leaders, not in the sense of you're a psychopath or whatever, but you could say, look, I see some tendencies in your profile. Do you recognize them? And you know, you could help coach people, you could have conversations about it. There's a lot of value if you could identify that.
Absolutely, because then you can help people connect with the why to their behavior, you know, and a lot of people don't really have the insight into, especially people high, well, like I said, but a lot of people don't have insight into why they're doing what they're doing. And by having this discussion, one of the great things of personality assessment is it helps people get in touch with the reasons why they're doing what they're doing. Yeah. And it clarifies for them why they're doing what they're doing. They may think that they're being agreeable, but in fact, they're not agreeable. Why do you think you are agreeable then? You know, what is it that you're doing? And maybe it's a different motivation that's leading you to those types of behaviors. Happens all the time. It's a great value for personality assessment is when you recontextualize people's personal sense of their motivations for why they do things. Sometimes people think that, what I'd add to that, not only does understanding ourselves change our tomorrow, but it makes our adaptive struggles less tedious and overwhelming. Life becomes easier to move through because we're acting in consonance with who we really are. We understand who we are, and therefore I can live more efficiently. Because when we don't understand who we are, there's just a lot of conflict. There's a lot of pushback that we get out of life, and it's what I call a personal drag coefficient. Each of us, a drag coefficient is on a car. It's the resistance. You know, as the car goes down the road, the wind slows it down. Same thing with our personalities, that sometimes we create our own backlash against us. And that we're working very hard because we're doing it incorrectly or inefficiently. And understanding who we are can make us much more streamlined and focused in what we're doing and feeling better about it as well.
So basically, you already talked about the big six, Ralph. What is and talking about, you know, your personal legacy, obviously, you know, the numinous, intellectual product, your skill. How do you see the future of Numinous? Do you think we'll ever see a moment when people will start about the big six? Do you see, let's say, the Numinous wider being accepted? What is your perspective on the status of the Numinous?
Well, it's a new idea. One of the places I get a little pushback is on the term the Numinous itself. People say, well, this is a different word, and how does that apply? And isn't that a theological term?
Yeah, absolutely. As a non-English speaker, you know that I also checked in with a couple of people like Numinous.
Well, actually, you know, it does have a tradition in psychology. Eric Erickson talks about the Numinous, and I find this a very interesting thing. It's part of his trust versus mistrust stage. It's the first stage. And the Numinous refers to the child's sense of you know, being in the presence of the mother, the caretaker, who saves the child, redeems the child from loneliness, cold, hunger, and wraps it in love. And the child is just the sense of awe and wonderment about this powerful figure that can provide for all of her needs and satisfy her desires, and that it's a very important part of the trust versus mistrust. And that's what I see. I think the numinous is part of who we are, and it's involved in our behavior from the very beginnings of life and takes us through our entire lifestyle. So I think it's got a lot of good psychological pedigree. And I think what it does, most importantly, it provides a nice organizing praxis for existentialism. Okay, that you look at people like Maslow and this, self-actualization.
What is that? Top of the pyramid.
But the numinous can tell you about that drive. Frankl talks about meaning, but like I said, some meanings are better than others. And I have the logoplex that articulates this more concretely. And this whole idea of worthiness, which is a whole second independent pathway to pathology, is something that needs to be brought into clinical work as an addendum for addressing some of these refractive disorders like moral injuries, body image dysphoria, substance abuse, and suicide. So I think it has real, real potential. I think it's new and it's different. But that's why the data is so important in what I'm doing, that you don't like my terms, you don't like my ideas, you don't like my thinking. That's fine. What do you think of the data? It's all data-driven.
Yeah.
And I've worked hard to create very good, high-quality data that supports everything that I say about this construct. So that to me is the most important.
Yeah, tell me, I worked through your articles, and as I said before, it brought all, let's say, the statistical tools, methodologies of my studies back. Yeah.
Yes.
There's the inevitable part of the tables and statistical significance and tests.
It's a data-driven approach, which makes it absolutely scientific. We're not getting off into the world of believing in God and theological or metaphysical issues. It's not that at all. To me, this is hardcore science, social science. It's all data-driven. It's been replicated cross-culturally, in different samples, different times, with different models. So, I feel confident about it because the data are just that good. And, you can disagree, but let's have a data discussion on that. Show me your data that doesn't go with mine. And so I think ultimately we will win the day. We just need to continue to wave the flag and get it out there and talk to people. And I'm hoping, God's grace, that this will give me a little bit more infinitude for myself.
Well, thank you so much, Ralph. I really enjoyed interviewing you, and I'm really looking forward to staying in touch.
I hope so, Dirk. Thank you very much. I appreciate your taking time out to talk with me and to share my ideas with your viewers. I do hope they get any value. And again, if they want to contact me, they can always go on drralph@thecfps.com. You can reach me there is my email. I have a website, which is Center for Professional Studies, all one word, .com. And you can see all the work that I'm doing, access my research articles, access my measures, and get a better idea about what I'm doing.
Thank you very much, and I will make sure that I will include that in the show notes.
Great, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I hope you liked listening to this podcast. If so, please feel free to like this podcast and leave your comments in the comment section of your podcast provider. If you want to get in touch with me about the contents of this podcast or about leadership and leadership development in general, please send me an email. My email address is dirk@dirkverburg.com. I'm looking forward to hearing from you.